Good afternoon. I call the Health and Social Services Committee to order at 1:31 p.m. on Thursday, January 20th. We're in the Butcher Bitch Room. Welcome back, everyone, and Happy New Year. Please remember to silence your cell phones as a courtesy. Committee members present today are Senator Reimel, Senator Hughes, Senator Casella, Senator Begich, and myself, Senator Wilson. We do have a quorum to conduct business. We also have a couple of new faces here to help assist the committee to conduct business. We have Mary Gwynn from Senate Records, and we have Leo, our Senate from Senate Records for our moderator, and Ms. Jasmine Martin is going to chair this committee for the time being. We're not chair, but you know, she always called herself Senator ever since that one committee meeting where she was introduced herself as Senator Jasmine. I always forget that aspect. But she is going to help staff said committee. This afternoon, we have one item of business. We will hear introduction and take invited and public testimony on House Bill 168, Electronic Application for State Benefits, which is sponsored by Rep. Snyder. I'd like to invite Rep. Snyder and her trusted staff to come on down and to introduce the bill. Just proceed when you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for the opportunity to present to this committee today. We're very grateful and excited to share this bill and what it does with you. So jumping right in, HB 168, it does one primary thing. It adds the option for Alaskans to apply or reapply for a variety of public assistance benefits. And just anticipating a question that has come up in previous conversations, I do want to emphasize that HB 168 does not remove any existing mechanisms or opportunities for individuals to apply for public assistance. It simply adds an online option. For those of you who might appreciate a refresher, folks apply to public assistance as it stands now, it does require a printed copy, which you can either mail in, you can deliver in person, you can fax it, and if you did have the ability to scan it in or take a photo and email it, that's also an option, but there is not the ability to fill it out online and hit the submit button. If you are curious what kind of applications we're talking about here, these include Medicaid for chronic and acute medical assistance, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, otherwise known as SNAP. It includes, adult public assistance, senior benefits program, heating assistance, women, infant, and children, otherwise known as WIC, the Commodities Supplemental Food Program for seniors over 60, and this would also allow online renewals and recertifications. We are one of the only states that has not yet modernized this part of the process of applying for public assistance, and this would bring us up to speed with other areas. I wanted to emphasize too, when we're talking about the paper copy, currently we often require a wet signature, so the electronic signature is not an option, and this would make that an option. And what happens is oftentimes going back and forth with these paper copies, they can be complicated in some instances. That takes a lot of time, that takes a lot of administrative time. There's costs associated with that, and we've seen delays historically, sometimes very significant, associated with that back and forth process. I am very happy to say, proud to say, that we've worked closely with the Department of Health and Social Services in the development of this bill, and it actually supports the modernization work that they've already begun engaging in. And they know it's important, we know it's important, and the train has already left the station, so to speak, on this. And this option now puts it in statute to continue supporting the longevity of this change. It also, by putting it in statute, we're setting the stage for regulation, for appropriation, and for implementation of these processes. And it also ensures a timeline that can keep us on task and make sure we get done what we know needs to get done. And then finally, I'll just conclude with a couple remarks regarding the budget. The efficiencies and cost savings that we anticipate with the online application, which we do, I mean, a big motivating factor of having the online application is achieving efficiencies and improving service for Alaskans. These efficiencies have already been accounted for in the governor's FY22 as well as the FY23 budgets. So in particular, you may recall in our discussions of the FY22 budget, there was a $3.4 million match from UGF that was cut in an elimination of 101 public assistance positions. And according to this year's upcoming budget, those positions are gone. They have been eliminated. And in the FY22 budget, another $848,000 in matching funds from UGF was cut in anticipation of savings in postage and printing and envelopes due to the availability of online submission forms. And looking forward in the 23 budget, there's an additional $215,000 in funds that have been eliminated because we no longer need some technologies that were being used by those 101 positions that are no longer there. So making sure we keep this process moving is pretty important because we've already banked on these forms functioning online. And I'll just close with a statement. Providing statutory support will be helpful to ensuring that eligible Alaskans have access to the services that get them back on their feet. That's the whole point, to get folks back on their feet. And again, like I said a moment ago, to make sure that we're achieving and maintaining those efficiencies that we've planned for. And unless Mr. Chairman would anything else, we can shift to the sectional analysis.
Yeah, let's do the sectional analysis, and then we'll take questions from committee members.
For the record, my name is Ariel Wiggins, Staff Representative Steyer. Section 1 of this bill adds a new subsection 19 to AS 4705010, Duties of the Department, requiring the Department of Health and Social Services to create and provide an entirely online application process for individuals applying for public assistance and defines an online application. It does not mandate applicants apply online or remove the written option. Section 2 amends 4708150B, Assistance for Chronic or Acute Medical Conditions, by adding language requiring the Department of Health and Social Services to establish an entirely online application process for individuals applying for the Chronic and Acute Medical Assistance Program. Section 3 adds a new subsection 6 to AS 4725001A, Powers and Duties, that requires the department to establish an entirely online application process and allows applicants to apply in any form required by state and federal law. Section 4 adds a new Section 7 to AS 4725071E, Child Care Grant Program, that requires the department to establish an entirely online application assistance application process for assistance under the Child Care Grant Program. Section 5 amends 4725095, Definitions for Daycare Assistance and Child Care Grant Programs, to define electronic application. Section 6 amends AS 4725050, Applications for Assistance, by adding language requiring the Department of Public Assistance, Division of Public Assistance, to establish an entirely online application process for individuals applying for assistance from the department, and defines an online application. Section 7 amends AS 4725440, Application for Assistance, by adding language requiring that the Department of Health and Social Services to establish an entirely online application process for individuals applying to receive adult public assistance, and defines an online application. Section 8 adds a new subsection 4 to AS 4725622, Alaska Affordable Heating Program, requiring the Department of Health and Social Services to create and provide an entirely online application process for individuals applying to the Alaska Affordable Heating Program, and defines online application. Section 9 adds a new subsection 4 to AS 4725980A, Duties of the Department, requiring the Department of Public Assistance to create and provide an entirely online application process for individuals applying for the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, and defines an online application. Section 10 amends AS 4727020A, Application Requirements, by adding language requiring the Department of Public Assistance to establish an entirely online application process for individuals applying for the Alaska Temporary Assistance Program, defines online application. Section 11 amends AS 4745302A, Cash Assistance Benefits, by adding language requiring the Department of Health and Social Services to establish an entirely online application process for individuals applying for the Cash Assistance Program, defines online application. Section 12 adds a new section to the uncodified law of the state of Alaska, allowing the Department of Health and Social Services to adopt regulations needed to create and implement online applications. Section 13 requires Section 12 to take effect immediately under AS 01-10070C. Section 14 provides an effective date of July 1st, 2022. Thank you.
All right. We have a couple of committee member questions. I will go Senator Reinbold, then Senator Baggage.
Okay. So first of all, it's nice to be back in committee. Number statewide is there people that this would be applicable to?
Yes, thank you. And I believe we have the director of the Division of Public Assistance on the line, Director Shauna O'Brien, who may be best positioned to answer that.
Not yet.
Not yet. Okay.
We're expecting her. She had a conflict, and I'm just asking that question. And so she will be here in 20 minutes. So I know we have an invited person for invited testimony. So if we need an answer from the department, because I have a couple of questions for the department as well, we can hold off on those. Go ahead, Senator Reinbold.
I'll ask another one. I've got like five questions, but I'll as you allow. You said this allows the option to apply online, but you're already doing it, so I'm a little confused.
Right. So,
if it's not allowed and this requires it to be allowed, but you're already doing it, then are you breaking the rules? I mean, you know what I'm saying? I'm trying to figure out why do we need this if you're already doing it or if they're already doing it.
If we have someone from Ledge Legal who wanted to add to this question, I would welcome that in terms of their reading of the statute. So yes, it is in process. They are adding an additional option, but it is not required. So our understanding is that it is permitted under the current writing of the statute, but it is not required. So what this bill would do would then add that online application option as a requirement within statute.
Okay, so then a trail I'm going to go down later, just for you to be aware, is data breach. I'm really concerned about data breach, and that's why I'm kind of resistant to all this, just knowing that we're also in state affairs dealing with all this data breach and lack of them dealing with all these major concerns. And when you're dealing with healthcare and applications, and I don't know, it just causes me pause right now. So I'll save other questions for later.
Senator Baggage, then Senator Hughes.
Thank you. One is a clarification, Mr. Chairman, and then the other is maybe just a bit of response, a little bit to what Senator Reinbold's bringing up. In terms of that latter point, you mentioned during your testimony, your presentation of the bill, that we've already budgeted for this to occur, and what this would do is ensure that the state couldn't backslide, and we've already budgeted for an electronic system by removing positions, and so we could end up, should we not have a requirement, we could end up with a situation where we can't process applications. Is that what I understood you to say?
Yes, I think that's a fair concern. I think you can look back and possibly even further, but if you were to look back at the 2015 performance audit of the department, even then it was noted that there were backlogs of 5 to 6 months at the time. That continued, and then come 2019, the onset of the pandemic, that backlog continued and possibly grew. We can get more specifics, I'm sure, from the director. We were able to hire an additional, I believe, 21 positions to deal with that backlog. It was addressed, got it down to 3 to 5 days in some instances. But now, again, to answer your question more directly, yes, we have significantly cut the budget in this particular area and in direct anticipation of the availability of the online applications. And so we could very well find ourselves in a significant backlog once again.
And Mr. Chairman, if I may, follow up. And I share Senator Reinbold's concern about data breaches, and I'm going to bring those up later when we have the director. I have a number of questions for the director, but just another clarifying point. You, over and over again during your sectional, use the phrase entirely online application. I want to clarify what you mean by that is all the programs when you say entirely, because you're still saying that there's the option for mail-in and for other options. Is that correct?
That is correct. And we went back and forth on this to make sure that we weren't inadvertently adjusting wording to have an outcome that was not the intended outcome. So the entirely online is meant to, my understanding, my recollection as we were drafting this is the entirely addresses the fact that you can hit submit and have your electronic signature attached to that submission. Because right now we do have the forms online, but you can't submit them online.
So, Mr. Chairman, just to further clarify, because that is different than my understanding. So that what I do understand then is your use, and this is for the record, because oftentimes 10 years from now when they're looking back, they're going to want to know what you meant by the phrase. Somebody will say, we don't take written applications because the law says entirely and the sectional says entirely. What you're saying is entirely simply means the ability to not only fill it out on form, but sign it just like we do with the permanent fund application.
That is correct. And all the other mechanisms remain intact and an option to applicants.
Okay, that's all I need. Thank you.
Sandra Hughes?
Yeah, thank you. By being the third one up to bat, all the bases are full, because I have the same concern about cybersecurity and breaches, because we're asking people to put personal information. And just as folks sitting at this table, we recently had to make sure, and you as well, our donate buttons related elections were not working. And so the person helping me with that needed my login information. And what I did, because I didn't want to text it, I took a picture of it and sent a photo. And so I'm really concerned, because you're going to have Alaskans providing personal information. So I'm very eager to hear from the department, because we've had a lot of problems in our state. Clarified entirely online applications as well. So basically, I mean, from start to finish, can do it that way if one person chooses, or they could still do the paper application. So the one thing I wanted to tie up, because you rattled off the different fiscal years and some positions being reduced and some dollars being reduced. So overall, looking at over the span, so let's just say for a second, everything they're doing right now, just start this, the online and your bill, if it all went away and we went all back to paper, how many positions would be needed and how much more money would be needed in the budget? In other words, what is the true savings when you add it all up for positions and dollars?
I will begin the answer to that question, give you the initial information, and then we will have to rely on the director to complete the answer. So in terms of how many positions we currently had previous heading into the pandemic, and then how many positions we currently have remaining, of those 101 positions that were cut, it is an important distinction to notice that as of towards the end of the previous session, 44 of those were empty for long term, so 6 months or more. Another 56 were either short term empty at the time, so or had been filled only for a short term, excuse me. So those positions, some of them were not filled, so we were functioning without those positions filled. But in terms of the second part of important information to answer your question, who do we have now and how many, that would be a question for the director.
Senator Hughes?
Yeah, and just one of this, just another one, and then I'll be done for now until we have the department, and that is going down through the sectional, I see the different programs. I'm not seeing Medicaid, so Medicaid is not part of this. Is that correct?
There is a component of Medicaid. It's Medicaid for chronic and acute medical assistance. That is one of the components. There's several forms that you can access on the division website, right? And one of those forms is a very lengthy form. It's been a while since I've scrolled through it. It takes a lot of scrolling to get through it. And it's a multi-application form if you're eligible for multiple programs. And that particular aspect of Medicaid is part of that long multi-applicant form.
Okay, so but the regular Medicaid is not, it's just this CAMA, which is pretty, it's only for certain conditions.
That's correct.
Okay, thank you.
At this time, let's go and take our invited testimony, and then we'll open up to public testimony, and hopefully by that time we can get the director will be available to call in. Online, we have Ron Meehan from the Food Bank of Alaska to provide an invited testimony. Ron, are you with us?
I am.
If you can state your name and affiliation for the record and begin your invited testimony.
Wonderful. Thank you, Chair Wilson, Vice Chair Hughes, and members of the committee. My name is Ron Meehan. I represent the Food Bank of Alaska as Policy and Advocacy Manager. We're a statewide organization and provide services across Alaska. I'm here to testify in favor of HB 168. The Food Bank of Alaska has a robust SNAP outreach team that is federally funded and carried out in partnership with the state. We provide education, outreach, application assistance, and case status updates for potential and current SNAP recipients. The present participation index for SNAP is 76%, meaning almost a quarter of the people eligible in Alaska are not accessing the program. Alaskans face significant and unique challenges in accessing benefits. One of the major barriers is a lack of options for how to apply, which the creation and addition of an online program will reduce. Alaska currently uses a paper application, which requires a pen to paper signature for SNAP and many other programs. There is an online submission option, but it requires someone to provide either a finger or stylus signature, which many people are not able to do. It does not replace a well-designed digital user interface. Not all communities have a DPA office, and offices are currently closed, which has made it more challenging to get a physical application. Some clients don't have access to the PDF application online, some don't have printing or mailing capabilities, and some just need help walking through and understanding the questions on the 28-page application. Our SNAP outreach team often assists people over the phone, asking questions of the client and filling the application out on our end. If a client doesn't have printing capabilities, which many do not, we then mail the application to them with a prepaid stamped return envelope. The client then reviews and signs the application and mails it back. When we're working with rural communities, this process can take several weeks, and it often means that applications are not submitted. We know some of these clients do have access to the internet and could self-submit, even with guidance over the phone, saving mailing time and cost. Wait times on the phone to submit an application are over 2 hours generally to the DPA. An online application could also lower costs by significantly reducing the need to print thousands of applications every year while also streamlining DPA processes. Another benefit of an online option is that it could simplify the application for clients. Although it is great that clients can currently apply for multiple benefits at the same time, it results in a long application with questions that can be irrelevant. An online application could be made predictive, only requiring clients to answer relevant questions. This would streamline the process for clients and likely create better efficiencies within the state's processing. An online SNAP application will allow Alaskans to universally reach this service, complete information at their own pace, and reduce the long application process. Offering a variety of application options is one of the surest ways to ensure access in a state as unique and diverse as Alaska. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to testify, and I'm happy to stay around and answer any questions.
Any questions for committee members to Ms. Meehan? Seeing no questions, thank you, Mr. Meehan, for your time and coming to testify, and thank you for what you do for Alaskans. At this time, we'll open up to public testimony. Is anyone here in the room in Juneau would like to testify on HB 168? Seeing none and seeing no one online, we will close public testimony, but we will still allow folks to submit public comment to the HESS committee email at shss@akleg.gov, and we'll take comment until Monday at 5 p.m. With that, and not saying that, we will take a 5-minute recess until we can get Director O'Brien on the phone. We are back from a temporary recess to allow time for our Director of Department of Public Health Health and Social Services, Public Assistance Director, to join us to answer a few questions from the committee members on House Bill 168. Director O'Brien, are you with us?
Hi, good afternoon. This is Shonda.
Hi. We will let you put yourself on the record, and we have a couple of questions here from Senator Reinbold. We'll let Senator Reinbold ask her questions and let you put yourself on the record, and then we'll go to Senator Begich, and I think back to Senator Hughes, and then we'll go from there. Senator Reinbold.
Okay, so thank you. We tried to get the information. We just want to verify about how many people statewide are receiving benefits in general that would be applicable in regards to this bill.
Thank you for the question. For the record, this is Shonda O'Brien, Director of Public Assistance. Currently, we have about 275,000, I believe, recipients on our programs. I'd have to look at our case numbers to make sure that that number hasn't changed since last I looked at it. But between 275 and 300,000 individuals are receiving public assistance benefits in our state.
Okay, I had 300,000 people written here, so I was pretty much on target. Just wanted to verify that. Second, I'm still trying to figure out the purpose of this bill, because if you're already doing it, then I don't understand why we need this bill. So can you just explain why this is necessary?
Again, for the record, this is Shonda O'Brien, Director of Public Assistance. That question isn't best something I can answer. Like you said, we are already in the process of developing electronic forms for our programs and do not feel like we need legislation in order to continue doing so. I believe that maybe the sponsor of the bill may be able to answer that question better.
Yes, we'll turn this over to the sponsor, but my understanding, and Representative Snyder can help out, I think this is just turning the may to a shall. But Representative Snyder.
Right, I think it's a directionality thing. We do not need it in statute to make the online application possible, but by placing it in statute, it means that it must always remain an option, and that is our interest, that this is a modernization, this is an improvement, this will improve services, this will improve efficiencies, and we want to make sure that it stays that way. Without putting it in statute, the online option could be revoked unless we had a change in statute if we were to pass this bill.
Thank you.
So you're probably not going to be happy with this, because when I read the bill, I was going to change on page 1, line 7, the shall to a may. So that was one of my amendments, because I don't like the forcing and things like that, because you never know, you know, what the future holds in regards to data privacy, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I don't particularly like the shall in there. A couple other questions I had was on page 2. There's one thing, it says minimum standards for personnel employment by the Department of Adopt Regulations. Can you tell me what kind of standards that are not in place that we need to put in place for personnel?
Just for clarification, these are already in statute. Those are not changes being made by this bill. That's language that already exists in statute. The changes come on page 4, on line 1
through
7.
The dark stuff.
Right.
So
those already exist. The shall and those things mm-hmm. are already in statute and are necessary for the administration of the various programs that the department and the division administers.
Okay, well, that's in conflict with what they just said. So when they said duties of the Department of Health and Services, it was may, and now it shall. Is it a may or a shall right now? Because O'Brien said may, and they said it was changing it to a requirement. So can we have clarity on that?
No.
I think I can offer the clarity, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, so I believe that this section is already in there in terms of what the Public Assistance Department currently already provides. The difference is on page 4 on that first line, this is just establishing the electronic portion of this. The others are for the written portions that are already there for the application process. And Ms. O'Brien may be able to help clarify that. Director O'Brien.
Thank you. For the record, this is Shonda O'Brien. That is my understanding as well. So the only change that would be in this bill is the allowability or the requirement to have an option for applicants to submit their documents electronically through an online application.
Who's that, a mayor show?
And so,
Mr. Chairman, at present, it is a may because it doesn't exist in statute. Right. They can choose to do it or not do it. They can choose to do it, and then a year later, they can choose to not do it. What this does is create a statute that says they shall do it.
Yeah, we'll take a brief at ease. back on the record. Senator Reinbold.
So if they, basically where we're going with this, this is always a debate. You guys know this. The shall and the may is like the number one debate I think we have in this entire legislature, because one becomes forced, one becomes optional. In the case of a massive data breach and things like that, and let's say like what the court system is going through, then what happens? Because if they shall, then they have to, they're forced to keep it up. So anyway, that's what, I don't like the shalls, to be honest with you. So that's kind of an issue. What will happen if there's a major data breach, which is pretty darn common in the state, pretty serious.
Right. So, Representative Snyder.
Yes, no, I think that's a great question. It's a concern, I think, that we all share as well. Alaska's privacy to their data, or their to keep their data private, is of utmost importance. I think it may be a great question to direct towards Ledge Legal in terms of what happened. Do we have any other examples of what happened with the data breach with the department that is still being cleaned up to this day? I imagine there were other instances of statute that includes the word shall, of services that they shall provide that were disrupted by the data breach. So what were the repercussions? What was the response? What were the implications? Because I imagine the answers to that, those questions would also apply in this instance.
Through the chair.
And I was just going to ask Director O'Brien, was there any, during the recent data breach, any programs or services that had a temporary halt in that? And were there other, any consequences, legal consequences or other consequences that the department faced due to that halt of services, if there were any?
Thank you for that question. For the record, this is Shonda O'Brien. The programs in my division, I can speak to. I can't speak to the rest of the department. In terms of the division and services that we offer through electronic means, we did have some disruption this past year. We had some systems that were affected in part, and we had some systems that were affected in total. Meaning we had our child care assistance and licensing system was completely disrupted in terms of being able to access it and use it for payments and things of that nature. So that system was completely taken offline. Where we had other systems that were affected in part. So part of the functionality being housed on a server that was affected by the cyber attack was causing that system not to function properly. And in our workload, because we do have paper forms and documents that we accept from individuals, most of the effect or impact of that was to the efficiency of how we do the work or how the work gets done. And so moving to a more manual process versus an automated process, creates a backlog of work that has to be caught up on when the systems are functional again, which is what we're experiencing with the child care program right now and with our work services program. Our other system that was affected, the time frame in which it was unavailable did cause work to have to be done in a different way, which made it more inefficient to getting the work done. You know, there's some cleanup effort that has to happen as a result of that. So most of what we've experienced, has been a combination of inefficiencies, the way we were doing work before, as well as catching back up on getting those systems updated and functioning again. In terms of, backup plans, I think one of the things that we definitely have at our disposal are, the manual processes and having paper documents for folks to continue to use. I think with any online application or automation of systems, you always have to have the option for folks to do to submit documents in a paper form. So we would continue to offer the ability for someone to print or pick up a paper document or application to submit however they choose. So if that means they want to fax it to us, or if they want to email a picture of it to us, or if they want to go online and submit it through the online application portal that we're developing, those are all the options that we would want to make available to anyone.
So
I think Senator Hughes has a question on that point that you just said, Director.
Well, a kind of a question comment, because I share the concern about the data, the exposure of the personal data. So I'm wondering if Director O'Brien could tell us if there is a breach and we're at risk of personal information being disseminated, is there something that requires the department to shut down the online portals and go strictly to paper, or do we need to put something in statute in order to protect privacy that would instruct, or would just be the decision of the commissioner whether to do it or not?
Through the chair, Senator Hughes, we do have protocols in place for addressing data breaches or security issues of whether it's a data breach or whether it's the system being infiltrated by something. In those cases, such as like with our cyber attack, the affected servers or network connectors would be taken offline immediately. And so we do have security protocols. The state does, as well as the Department of Health and Social Services. And so those measures are in place now and being used. And so if that were the case, hypothetically in the future, those same measures would be taken. The information would be, you know, the breach or the security event would be investigated to determine the degree to which data might have been taken or infiltrated. And then we would have to have a backup such as what you just described in order to allow folks to continue to apply for and receive benefits for the programs. And so those are some of the protocols that we put in place, and you know, some of that falls into our continuity of operations. Some of that falls into requirements that we have to adhere to for federal purposes and things of that nature. So there are measures that we have to take, and there are legal requirements in place to ensure that we are doing what we need to ensure the safety of that information.
So just quickly, internal protocols can change, and even though they might right now be based on best practices, there's nothing, it sounds like, statutorily requiring that. And as our Constitution has pretty strong language about privacy and the job of the legislature, it would seem like that might be something we should consider just as a protection as we are moving more and more towards online for a lot of things. And I will say, you know, in this day and age, we do a lot electronically. And if we're reducing the number of positions, we're saving money, it's efficient, et cetera. I like that, but I just want to make sure that people's personal information is protected. So and maybe this is something that should be addressed in state affairs overall as far as for all the departments and on all the online things. But I would ask the bill sponsor, if we were to put something in to at least protect this little area, if the bill sponsor would be comfortable with that, you know, in the event of course, we'd have to talk legal as far as language, but in the event of any kind of risk to exposure of personal information, that these would revert to paper applications until such time it's safe to go back online.
And I guess that's a question that Director O'Brien can get back to us on. Maybe that's something that's already in place if the commissioner or their designee has that ability to waive this statute if this was in place. I think that's a question, and then we can definitely, during the amendment process, Legislegal might be able to determine that. I think Senator Casello has a quick comment on the same point, and then we'll go to Senator Baggage for a question.
Thank you, Senator Wilson. And I do think this topic of cybersecurity is pretty critical, and the State Affairs Committee meets next in this room, and we are going to be having a presentation on cybersecurity. So I'm sure the chair of that committee would welcome Senator Hughes to join in, or any other senator, because that topic will be discussed in this room right after this meeting.
Senator Baggage.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First on this topic, I have a number of questions for you, Director O'Brien, but on this topic, under Section 10 and Section 12 of the bill, you have regulatory transition language under Section 12. And isn't it true that the regulations are where you establish the protocols that determine when you will or won't turn off these things. I mean, it's done regulatorily now, isn't it? Director O'Brien?
Through the chair, Senator Buggett. So in terms of HIPAA and confidentiality compliance requirements, I'm definitely not the subject matter expert for the department or the state in how those are carried forward and where it's legally, you know, binding for the state. I do think that the security office would definitely want to weigh in on the legalities behind it. In terms of operational purposes and how it affects me and my staff and the division, you know, I can speak to those types of things. Because our agency is required to adhere to HIPAA compliance and we have a number of confidentiality requirements to adhere to for not only federal purposes, but for state-related reasons. You know, we do take those measures to ensure that we are following all of the rules and compliance requirements associated with our federal oversight agencies and others. I think for your question about the bill, you know, we would be looking to those resources outside of this bill for operationalizing those measures and not necessarily looking specifically to the electronic application language to satisfy all of those requirements. Hopefully that helps to answer that question.
Well, Mr. Chairman, if I may continue, it appears that it does answer the question. Your regulations, if I remember the Administrative Procedure Act, in the code relating to numerous, at least when I was at DJJ, numerous entities, they refer in the regulations to the federal laws and those very protections. We make reference to them in our regulatory processes, don't we? Like HIPAA and those things are referred to in our regulations within the department now, within your division now. Isn't that correct?
Correct. Yes, you are correct.
All right. So all I'm saying is that we may be making a lot out of a little because there are protections that are written into the federal the federal laws you have to abide by. But the question that both Senator Hughes and Senator Reinbold have underlined and underscored does relate directly to the data breach that occurred in the department. And so really, I have a broader question because this act would say that this becomes one of the options. You would be able to, as a consumer, use electronic data as one of your options. That wouldn't preclude the other options, but under the response to the current data breach that's occurred, what are the protections that you have in place? Because I think that's really the question we're getting at here. What are the protections that the division and the department have in place now as a result of a data breach that we're all now aware of from the press and from what's been presented to the public? So what are the ones so that we can assure our constituencies that this is doing nothing to expand data risk? Is that a question?
Senator Begich, I believe that it would be better for someone from the Department Security Office or even from the State Security Office to speak more explicitly at that level. I'm not going to be able to give you the level of detail that they could give you. Like I said, I'm speaking more from an operational standpoint within my own division and not necessarily at the security level that maybe the State Security Office would be able to speak to.
Mr. Chairman, yes. Director Biden, you've answered. I should have answered the question before you had to go through that. This is effectively what I'm saying is, and we should get a presentation because that breach did affect the department that's under this committee's jurisdiction. So I hope we will get a presentation on the response to the data breach at some point. But the answer that they will give will be one that will apply to all functions within the department. So I think that will be also the answer that we are asking in terms of these issues. So I think that does answer that question. Can I just ask you a couple quick questions about if this bill passed, how you might address a few populations with this additional system? Is that all right if I ask those questions, Chairman?
Yes, please.
All right. So, Director O'Brien, you know we have a diverse population. It includes people whose first language may be an indigenous language, may not be English. Do you work with other public interest groups that this legislation passed to help identify ways to ensure that the forms are accessible online in various languages, or is that something that you would normally do?
Through the chair, Mr. Begich, yes. Right now what we offer is interpreter services through a language line for individuals who aren't English speaking, or English isn't their primary language. We offer that service through a contract with a language line service, and then they offer, I think the last time I looked at the numbers, we have over 200 language options through that service. With an online application or even with a paper form application, we have limited ability to provide all of those language options in a written form, but certainly we have the ability to improve on the way that that's communicated to individuals so that they can understand where they go to get the interpreter services they need. So we may not be able to offer, you know, an application experience in every single language option there is, but we are working to provide better ways to communicate with individuals about how they, you know, how they can get those services in a more clear way.
And just to follow up on that, Mr. Chairman, also with those with disabilities and such, like vision impairment, that kind of thing?
Through the chair, Senator Begich, yes. We are looking at ways to improve on that right now. We definitely know that that is an area that we can continue to improve on. And I think electronic options do give us a little bit more variety in how we might be able to solve for some of that than with a paper form that may be a little harder to reach or find. So we're hopeful that the electronic options will give us maybe some alternative solutions to what we have now.
Two more very quick questions, Mr. Chairman.
We're going to go to Senator Reinbold.
One is just in terms of you know as well as everyone here does that not all of Alaska has access to high-speed internet and those kinds of things. And I guess the way you would address the potential barriers of low bandwidth would be that you still have the other forms available. Would that, I don't want to answer the question for you, but is that your way of, if this, even with the process that, that's ongoing now, but even without this legislation, is that how you perceive this as just like a menu of options and ways to do this, to apply?
Through the chair, Senator Begich, that is the option, unfortunately, for our state where bandwidth is an issue in so many of our communities. You know, the paper option is always going to be available for individuals who prefer that method, whether it's by choice or because they don't have any other alternatives. However, I do want to add that with the implementation of a virtual contact center last year, we are now able to accept applications over the phone. And so that will still continue to be an option even with the electronic application. So if an individual is struggling to get their application submitted electronically or just prefers to call our office to have their application taken over the phone, we are able to accept the signature over the phone. And so that has been a really positive solution that we've been able to implement this past year.
Last point.
Senator Begich, and then Sandra.
Thank you. And Director O'Brien, perhaps a little tongue-in-cheek, but if I were governor and you were my director and I said under present law I no longer want you to do electronic forms, you would take my direction as director and stop those forms, wouldn't you?
Through the chair, Senator Begich, I believe if that were the direction of the governor's office for my position, I would have to honor that request, yes.
Right, and I just point that out simply because the point that the representative was making is that that's exactly what a governor could do, and that's why the statutory option versus the May option might be the best if we know that the data is protected, because we're going to get a broader protection data presentation here. So I just wanted to make that point. I think that's important for us to understand. And no, I'm not going to be governor and direct that.
Yet.
Senator
Reinbold.
Thank you. I just think it's amazing, this committee, because
I'm totally on board with this whole data breach and the protection of privacy in Article 1, Section 22. And the Constitution is clear when people said it's only our only constitutional duty. I said, you haven't read the Constitution. There's about 100 duties in there, and one of them is protecting privacy. And it's the legislature that has to do that. And I think we are failing miserably, to be honest with you. When Senator Costello, brought up the fact that we're doing a presentation right after this, 3:30, I actually thought it was part of this today, you know, because I have the presentation right here. So you're right on board, you know, in regards to the serious problems we're having with the Division of Elections, in addition to Health and Social Services. Also with the liability with the band risk, you know, I hadn't even thought about that. You know, a lot of places don't have the band width. And I'm also concerned that if it says you shall, where my concern is if the power goes down or if we have a data breach and it's shut down so long, then it may create liability or concerns or issues that pursuing potentially. I'm not sure, but I just want to chase that out. Now that I'm in court, I am thinking about things a lot differently than I used to think about things. And the last thing I wanted to say is when Senator Begich, we might go down the same trails, which is amazing. When I watch you, I'm like, that's exactly what I was thinking. But his conclusion is different than my conclusion at the end. But but the bizarre thing is at 2:13, I wrote down that I wanted to get a presentation from the security, and then he did it at like 2:23 or something like that. So it's just interesting that I think we're kind of all on board here for getting the data breach, because it was a huge, huge, huge issue. And just understanding that, I'm on HES and I'm on the subcommittee, and I haven't had a thorough presentation on it. So I think that would be really helpful.
Director Byrne, I have a couple of questions here. Within, I guess, the way that you're currently doing this through online and through telephonically, are there any concerns of or ways that you can verify sort of fraud for folks that are without having the signature component of this, or to verify that individual?
Mr. Chair, we do have authentication requirements that are pretty standard requirements under our different federal rules and regulations. So, you know, in terms of an online application, the authentication process is going to have multiple steps in order to validate and verify who the individual is. From a fraud perspective, we do have an entire fraud unit that do fraud detection, waste and abuse reviews of all of our recipients in the program through data mining exercises and a number of other means that they use to, you know, look for any detection of fraud or abuse. I think I'm trying to make sure I answer your questions early about the online presence. You know, right now with, for example, you can submit your Medicaid application through MyElastic credentials. So we have the Medicaid applications already available online for folks to submit. And you would have to have a MyElastic account to authenticate who you are. And, you know, the process for doing that is already established. And if you've ever used it to apply for your fishing license or for your PFD, then you know that there are steps already embedded into that process that require you to validate who you are. Okay. And so we're looking to use similar authentication requirements for other programs as well, so that we have as much information up front about who the individual is and how they are able to identify themselves.
And Director O'Brien, you bring up a point where MyElastic, for let's example, fishing license, I could purchase fishing licenses for other individuals as long as I have their information. So for this process for public assistance, does the person receiving the benefits have to apply, or can someone apply on their behalf?
Mr. Chair, the process for applying for benefits, if you are an authorized representative for that individual, so that means that the person has given you their permission to apply on their behalf, then it's acceptable for you to work with the agency to get the information submitted and to help, you know, answer questions or follow up on case-related information. And that happens pretty frequently, especially with our senior populations or individuals who need additional assistance in applying for benefits due to a number of reasons, right? So that's already happening, whether it's in paper form or online. To prevent somebody from applying for somebody else's benefits online where they aren't an authorized representative, you know, like I said, we have fraud detection measures in place to monitor for that. I believe, we will be working very diligently to ensure that all of those steps are taken as we continue to develop, you know, online applications and forms for all of our programs. And so, if somebody gives you their credentials and information to apply on their behalf, we wouldn't necessarily know that that was the case unless we needed to communicate with that person directly, regarding their application. And at that point in time, if that person is an authorized representative for them, we would be able to talk directly with them. If they aren't, then we wouldn't be able to communicate about the case.
All right. Thank you. Any other questions for committee members to the Director O'Brien?
Senator Reinbold.
I'm just a little blown away that people can, over the phone, authorize somebody to do this. I mean, we have about 300,000 of about 700. I don't know what our population is right now. We already have about half our population, you know, on benefits. And just to think that, I can tell somebody to go do it online. And it just seems like when you look at the audit, alleged budget and audit report, which I'm planning on bringing here, we got some issues we need to address with fraud, waste, and abuse. Rather than expanding a broken program, we need to really get to the bottom of it. So I'd like to, if we're going to do this bill, then I think we need to put a couple more things in the bill to make sure that we're not expanding a broken problem, but fixing a problem that already exists, and then making it easier for applicants. In the big picture, if that's what the ultimate goal, I'm still trying to figure out what the ultimate goal of this is. If they can already do everything in regulation, the department says they don't need it, I'm still trying to figure out why we need this bill in the first place. That's why I really wanted to ask Representative Snyder, what's the ultimate goal of this bill?
I'm not sure I know how to rephrase it any additional ways. I apologize.
No, that's fine. Just give a quick moment. I just want to make sure there's no other questions for Director O'Brien before we let
I guess
go.
I'll ask one more, if that's right.
Yeah, Senator Baggage, and then we'll let Representative Snyder sort of have closing remarks and to respond to Senator Reinbold's question.
Yeah. Director O'Brien, this is just a question I have in general, and it relates to this bill because this bill would allow for an electronic the electronic system, but you already are doing electronic applications, so this question is relevant, which is what do you do to protect our applicants now? You know, from being, you know, consumer protection is what I'm looking at here, to keep, for where you require opt-in or opt-outs for information. Are there opportunities to sell information, or are there, any kind of that third-party entity purchasing and buying of information? I mean, what do we do now to protect our consumers from that kind of approach? I know you must have some regulatory processes, but would you mind just sharing a few of those with us?
Sure, through the chair, Senator Baggage. We don't sell or share any of the information. Our data and security protocols, have to follow HIPAA and confidentiality standards. The information that we receive into our system is protected from the point of access. So as somebody signs into their MyAlaska account to submit their Medicaid application, from that point forward, all of that information as it moves through the network and ultimately into our servers and our systems are protected at multiple layers and levels throughout the state security system. I can't really give you specific regulations in this hearing, but we could certainly follow up with you on some of the citations around how we ensure that information is secure and what kind of federal regulatory oversight there is in terms of how the information is protected from third party and whatnot.
Director, follow up?
Yeah.
I very much appreciate that, and I'm not in a rush to get that information, but I wouldn't mind having it just for the record, just for us to have it. So don't feel under some tremendous time pressure to provide it, but I would love to know what our consumer protections are, because I actually don't know the answer to the question I asked. But I do want, there was an assumption made about fraud here. I want to, what is the incidence of fraud with this, with our 300 plus, or 270 to 300,000 annual applicants? What is the incidence of fraud that occurs?
Through the chair, Senator Begich, I do not have that information off the top of my head today for last year's numbers. We have a report that we produce annually that outlines all the different cases of fraud that have been investigated, and it even includes claim information on recoveries and things of that nature that we could share with the committee.
I would appreciate that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Reinbold.
And to that point, when I was on a, I'm still on the Health and Social Services Subcommittee, I can't recall a single statute that actually deals with penalties for people with fraud. I correct me if I'm wrong, but there is penalties for providers. There's lots of penalties if there's an abuse with providers. So if I'm missing something, I would love to, you know, be corrected. But I remember asking and drilling down on this issue, and that's where my concern is, that it could be, you know, if someone can apply for someone, like when we ran into someone from Hawaii and they hang out in Hawaii and get benefits there, and then they come here in the summer and get benefits here, that happens. And I just want to make sure we're not going to be expanding a program that's already gargantuous and already needs to be fixed right now so it's sustainable in the future. We need a sustainable program, and that's where my concern is.
And fraud is theft, and so the Department of Law would be, you know, depending on the prosecution and how that works, but people do get prosecuted for theft of services, for fraud. I've seen that. I've had clients that were prosecuted for those fraudulent services that they've claimed on their applications.
So. I'd love to see the statute. So. Yes.
All right. With that, I just want to say thank you, Director O'Brien. There's no other further questions for you. Rep. Snyder, do you have any final closing remarks in response to the committee members' questions or comments?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for the opportunity. I'll just close with reemphasizing the three primary motivators for this bill. One, that it modernizes it, and it modernizes our process in statute, so it's robust and it's resilient, and it can't be revoked on a whim. And this modernization is actually, I did not mention earlier, this was recommended many years ago, as early as 2006, by the USDA, that this is the direction to go to achieve the efficiencies and to improve access. And like I said earlier, we're one of the last states to do it. I can commit to digging in a little bit and addressing some of these concerns that may have been addressed by other states that are ahead of us on this front, and I'm sure there's lessons to be learned, and would be more than happy to provide those. I think the second motivation is the removal of barriers to access. We have these programs. We heard just a moment ago from the Food Bank of Alaska. Of course, that's just one program that would be served, but only about 75% of eligible Alaskans actually partake in that, and some of that limitation is due to access. And it's been documented too, it's even if they get initial access, the back and forth and the difficulties associated with completing those forms oftentimes results in them quitting early and not actually finalizing that. And then lastly, I'll just point to improved efficiency. That is really our third and final motivator. This can help us run these programs at a lower cost. And if we are able to do that, if we are more efficient, it allows us to redirect some of that time and resources to some of these concerns that I've heard you raise, which are very important concerns, talking about fraud and talking about issues of security. It improves our bandwidth to address those. And the last thing I'll say is, if you look back at the 2015 audit of the department, it was specific. This, the Division of Public Assistance, was specifically called out and recognized for their very strong and efficient focus on issues of fraud and checking the work of the individuals processing the forms. And I'll close with that. And I guess, if I may, I want you to know I've been taking copious notes. I think some interesting and very important points were raised, and our office is committed to answering, finding those answers to those questions that we weren't able to answer today, and we'll get that back to you as soon as we can. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you again. We're going to set this bill aside. We're going to set this bill aside and bring it up at a later date. If committee members have amendments, we'll set a deadline for Monday, the 24th, 5 p.m. And that concludes our amendments. I mean, our business for this afternoon. A little rough start here to Senate House for this new year. But that concludes our business. Are there any closing committee member comments?
I think I would just point out, Mr. Chairman, thank you, that 4705210 deals with at least Medicaid fraud as a criminal offense. It is a criminal offense and punishable as a Class A misdemeanor, so that is an offense on the books. Just so you know, 4705210, and there are probably some other references. I just had a moment to look at the statutes.
Okay.
Thank you. Senator Reinbold.
Thank you very much. I just want to drill down in regards to this because I don't know if that when we had the discussion in the health subcommittee, it was for the provider, not necessarily the applicant. If it is the applicant, excellent. Fantastic. Okay. So then I think there were zero cases, but I want to dig in to it because I don't think it's something that they're actively doing. But I know when I read the audit that it is a significant problem.
Yes, and that audit is the fraud, waste, and abuse audit that comes out in November.
Mm-hmm.
All right. With that, we will be adjourned at 2:45 p.m.